It's now the 31st of October.
I thought of another wartime activity, which is of some importance in my preparing for the work I eventually got into at the University of Wisconsin. This involves a man named Hermann Mark, who is sometimes known as the father of polymer science. He was one of the very few people who made basic physical chemical investigations on polymers before the war, first in Germany and then in Austria at the University of Vienna. He left Austria, probably around 1940. I think he left before the Germans invaded Austria. He had some Jewish ancestry. And he ended up at the Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn, an institution which in no way was worthy of his eminence and ability, and started building up some polymer research there. It was a hand-to-mouth existence with dribbles of money from industry and eventually some military contracts. And one very important military project was developing plastic film for packaging. Nowadays, of course, everything you buy is wrapped up in plastic, but in those days, plastic film of this sort had not been invented. And the military were interested in something that could wrap up various things, especially in the tropics, in machinery to avoid corrosion. And there was quite an active program developed. On Saturdays, every month or so, there would be a meeting to review the progress, and a number of people were invited to attend as advisory people, and I was one of those. So I went very often to the Brooklyn Polytechnic for these meetings, and became acquainted with a number of people who later became very prominent in the early development of polymer science. Their names are Paul Doty, Bruno Zim, Turner Alfrey, and Arthur Tobolsky, whom I've mentioned before. At one point, Professor Mark tried to hire me away from Harvard to work on a very peculiar hush-hush project. Some people in England had found that a mixture of ice and sawdust was a very strong and easily workable construction material, and they developed the wild idea of making a huge barge which would support people in an invasion, troops in an invasion, floating on a huge piece of ice and sawdust.
This was just written up in the New Yorker a few weeks ago.
I must have missed it. My copies haven't been coming for the past 2 weeks.
interesting.
I finally got some replacement copies. I'll be very interested to see this. But I decided against it because obviously there was no future in this work or at that institution. Another event in the wartime years, which is far more important than anything else I've discussed, was my marriage. Barbara Norton Mott graduated from Radcliffe in 1942 and immediately after joined our group at Woods Hole working on ship bottom paint. We were married in 1944. And by that time, I was working half-time in Boston, half-time in Woods Hole. So we had two apartments, neither of which was at all satisfactory for living conditions. And first, Barbara stayed in Woods Hole, and I was alone in Boston. Later, she moved to Boston, and I went back to Woods Hole. Toward the end, we didn't have an apartment. I simply rented a room. As the war drew to an end, I could see that not only was there very little prospect for what is now known as a tenure track appointment at Harvard. There might have been at MIT, but there was another man there working on polymers, Walter Stockmeyer, who has been a good friend of mine over the years and also very prominent in the development of polymer science. Not only were the opportunities very slim, but I felt I couldn't maintain an adequate standard of living on the salaries of younger faculty in Cambridge. I had the impression that most people who were living comfortably had independent incomes, and I think that's still true to a considerable extent. I know of people in recent years who declined full professorships at Harvard because they felt they couldn't afford it.
I shall have to ask. I'm interviewing somebody there who's just gone there from Wisconsin.
Well, recently I was on the visiting committee for chemistry for the Board of Overseers and learned a lot about the problems they've had in their chemistry department, and that is one. Well, So I began actively to look around for some place I could go to teach physical chemistry and set up a research program. And the opportunities were very sparse anywhere in the country at
still
that time.
Because of the reluctance to accept polymer chemistry.
Yes, indeed. I have become acquainted with Jack Williams because of his association with the plasma fractionation project in Boston. He and Robert Alberti and Harold Deutsch came frequently to consult about the collaborative work they were doing. There was equipment at Wisconsin that was not available in Boston, in particular the ultracentrifuge. The Wisconsin ultracentrifuge was the only one at a university at the time. I think there was only one other in the country, and that was at the DuPont laboratories. And it was used a great deal in the course of the plasma fractionation program.
Do you mean that, you don't mean that it was used for work being done in Boston, do you?
Oh, yes, it was.
You mean you'd take, bring things?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I see.
And this, in fact, led to some friction. I don't know whether Professor Williams mentioned it in his interview, but Dr. Cohn wanted to use him as a purely routine laboratory that simply making measurements and tests for the Harvard program, and Dr. Williams actually wanted to do some investigations of his own, and eventually he was able to do this by the intervention of higher authorities because there were government committees that were supervising all the war research. And in particular, Professor Baird Hastings, who was professor of biochemistry at Harvard, head of the Department of Biochemistry, recalling that Cohn's department was called physical chemistry in the medical school. Hastings intervened on Jack Williams' behalf.
What was Jack Williams' reputation then? I mean, did he have one?
Well, I would say he did not have a particularly prominent reputation, no. I think he said himself that before the war years, these would not be exactly his words, but he worked on odds and ends and did not have an intensive, coherent program, and that he learned how to do this when he was associated with the Harvard group during the war years.
As I told you, I was not thinking about his research when I interviewed him.
Yes.
So anything you have to say on those lines is new and interesting, unless he's written it up somewhere.
Well,
I gather he does. He has had quite a reputation later on.
Yes, he did, and I think he did some very ingenious things with the ultracentrifuge. Now I'm going to say something that is perhaps indiscreet. You recall that Onkley was a graduate student of Williams. I mentioned Onkley in the Cone Laboratory. During the war years, Onkley had a very important role in developing the plasma fractionation details and in coordinating work at the various industrial firms that were producing the plasma fractions. And he was in charge of a kind of ultracentrifuge that Cone had, which never turned out to be as satisfactory as the famous Svedberg ultracentrifuge, which was installed here. I think that Cohn said, Williams does finger exercises on his ultracentrifuge and Onkley composes symphonies.
Oh.
My reaction, though I didn't say so, it wasn't apparent. My present reaction wasn't apparent quite then, but I would say exactly the reverse. Onkley used the centrifuge to make routine measurements, and Williams did some quite ingenious experiments with his. But that's just an indication of Cohn's manipulations of which I'm not familiar with all the skullduggery that Cohn apparently was involved in, but there are others who have referred to it, and he was of course a very successful scientific entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
But he manipulated individuals and denigrated some and elevated others. He received an honorary degree from Harvard in, I think it was about 1944, and President Conant's citation described him as the resourceful and energetic driver of a scientific team.
Just aptly chosen words.
Whereas another chemist who had been very active in war work, I think it may have been Roger Adams of Illinois, also received an honorary degree. It may not have been in the same year, but his citation was, men and molecules react benignly as he plans, which was a much nicer statement. I was simply overjoyed when Jack Williams said there might be a chance of my coming out here.
Excuse me, wasn't Conant involved in this work also?
He didn't have anything to do with plasma fractions.
He didn't?
No.
Why did I think that you might have run into him?
Well, he had, he was involved in war research at a much higher level.
Okay.
We're talking about.
Sorry.
Yes.
Yes, so you were overjoyed when when you got an invitation to come here.
Well, it, Jack Williams asked me if I would be interested, and I said I certainly would, and then things developed without my hearing anything about it. Eventually, to my amazement, I received the offer of a position without ever having been invited to interview out here.
Really?
So
was Farrington Daniels chairman?
No, J.H. Matthews was.
Oh, he was still chairman.
And so Professor Williams must have been able to convince the department to offer me the position. In spite of the fact that I think that a number of people in the department were not terribly impressed by Professor Williams' work.
Mm. So it's all the more surprising that a candidate of his should have been accepted.
Yes.
Do you know anything more about it?
No,
did
I don't.
Did you find anything
I
more about it?
I don't know a thing. Although once in Boston, I received a phone call. A voice said, "This is Homer Adkins." And fortunately, I had investigated the department enough so that I knew who Homer Adkins was. And he invited me to his hotel. He traveled a great deal all over the country during the war on various business, and he happened to be in Boston. And so I was interviewed by Homer Adkins.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd already received the offer of an assistant professorship. My friends at Harvard said that I really ought to ask for a tenure appointment.
Mm-hmm.
I was, how old was I, 34, I guess. No, 30, 32, perhaps. I mentioned it to Adkins, and he said he hoped I wouldn't insist on that because a majority of his colleagues didn't think it was appropriate.
Yeah. Oh.
And I didn't insist on it.
Yeah. What did he ask you? Do you remember? What did you talk about?
Some general questions about my research interests, which he didn't think much of because. He was an organic chemist, and I don't think he was much interested in any other kind of chemistry, but I must have satisfied him.
What was your impression of him?
Well, I don't think I've formed any firm impression at the time. I knew he was a very distinguished organic chemist.
Mm.
Well,
was Mrs. Ferry still working at this time?
No. Our daughter was born in February 45, and she was not working.
Yeah.
We were, and I'd left Woods Hole. We were living in an apartment on Longwood Avenue near the medical school. And she was not involved in any work at that time. Cohn tried to persuade me not to accept the appointment, and he and several other people, I'm sure at his urging, tried to persuade me not to accept it. But
why?
Oh, what sort of reasons? One of them said something I thought was terrible, that that Jack Williams was a rather dull person, and if I came out here, I wouldn't find the atmosphere very stimulating. Others claimed that the Wisconsin Department had a lot of dissension and backbiting, which I don't think was true either. But
they didn't offer you more money to stay.
No, nor did they offer me any prospect of a permanent appointment.
Oh,
it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I came out here in January of 45, and shortly after my wife and daughter arrived, and we moved into a temporarily rented house belonging to Gaines Post, who was on sabbatical, not sabbatical, we didn't have any, of course, on leave.
Yeah.
I came down with hepatitis and had to spend several weeks in bed.
Which awful.
Was terrible frustration.
What was your impression of Madison when you came?
I had driven through Madison several years before on one of several transcontinental automobile trips.
I see. So you'd seen it.
And hello. And I thought that if I ever had to live in the Midwest, which I had never seriously considered, that this wouldn't be too intolerable.
Yes.
And I don't think my wife was very pleased about moving to this part of the
country. She was from Massachusetts?
Yes, yes.
Where was she from?
Well, she grew up in North Attleboro.
Oh.
And her parents had come from Vermont. So she and I, of course, had grown up on the Pacific Coast, so our backgrounds were quite different. But I always felt very much at home in New England. My ancestors settled in Western Massachusetts in the 1600s, and I felt ties with that part of the country. Well, we felt that Madison was a very provincial community, of course, but I found the working conditions at the university excellent from the very beginning. Of course, in the, right after the war, we had excellent, mature graduate students. One of my first graduate students had been a major in the Army. And they were very practical, hardworking, and we soon made a very good start on research. Now, I think I'd like to ask you where to proceed, how to proceed at this point. When I arrived, Professor Matthews told me that he hoped I would develop a program in polymer chemistry which would parallel Williams's research in protein chemistry. But he wanted me to be independent of Jack Williams.
Now, why both? He didn't, he had decided that polymer chemistry was acceptable.
Yes, he, of course, early he'd been very enthusiastic about colloid chemistry. The back in the 1920s, this is all is well documented,
yes,
in the archives, I'm sure, that he fostered the development of colloid chemistry, and Williams originally was supposed to be a colloid chemist, and And he did make a number of contributions in colloid chemistry. Mm-hmm. In some sense, both protein physical chemistry and polymer physical chemistry grew out of colloid chemistry because all three subjects involve either large molecules or large particles, large aggregates of molecules. Mm-hmm. In the case of colloid chemistry, they're aggregates. And it took a long time for the scientific community to accept the idea that proteins and polymers were not aggregates too, uh-huh. but they were true molecules. Well, maybe you better turn it off for a minute while I collect. The attitude of most chemists to polymers was perhaps influenced by the fact that organic chemists for years sometimes obtained tarry or gummy byproducts from their reactions, which they always threw away. And some of these things were polymeric. And people were very skeptical that large molecules, even if they existed, could ever be treated by exact theory.
Oh.
Could ever be explained in terms of quantitative basic scientific relationships. Mm-hmm. And here was where Florey, whose name I mentioned before, played a very important role in showing that many features of polymers could be described by very elegant theories. And some of the people who worked with Hermann Mark, whose names I mentioned before, also contributed to this, mm-hmm. as well as Stockmeyer, my friend at MIT. So polymers gradually became respectable.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, by contrast, many chemistry departments are very eager to find people who are interested in polymers to add to their faculties.
Yes, it's the biggest division of the
American Chemical Society. And it's the biggest segment of chemical industry by far.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I had asked you something about the, let's see, how influential was Farrington Daniels in the department?
He was the most distinguished physical chemist at that time. He was not a member of the National Academy. Homer Adkins was, and McIlvaine was elected soon after I came here, but I'm pretty sure that Daniels was elected after that.
Mm. How much, incidentally, emphasis do you give to election to the National Academy? I mean, how good a clue is it to the quality of a person's work?
Oh, it's a pretty good clue. I would say that there are many people of academy caliber who've never been elected, but election is, of course, it's more a perception of eminence than eminence itself. But I think it's a pretty good clue.
Mm-hmm. So you would have rated them in that way, also, that Adkins and McIlvaine were. Had
a better national
more.
Reputation. Mm-hmm. Yes. Daniels wasn't at all interested in polymers.
Well, I see. I think I'm quoting Williams in from his interview. Who was quite bitter, I guess, about Daniels.
Well, unfortunately, Jack Williams became bitter about both Matthews and Daniels and Dean Ingram and
short everyone.
Well, he idolized Edwin Fred.
Yes, he did say that. Yes.
I've never heard him say anything critical about President Fred.
Hmm.
And his attitude toward Conrad Elvium was neutral, I would say. I've never heard him either praise or criticize that I recall.
Yeah. And when was it Homer Adkins, or the department said that you were to set up a polymer chemistry
yes.
program and not to be separate from Williams, what?
Well, this was Matthews' idea.
Matthews.
I think Matthews had some reservations about Jack Williams' style. He said he always had trouble that just when he thought he had Williams pinned down in a particular place, suddenly Williams would be off some other place. And he said, don't you ever develop a temperament like some of Williams' unpredictability. When I came, he was very generous in giving me a couple of graduate students who had really signed on to work with him. But he also said I could have another graduate student, and that didn't turn out. I decided that I didn't want to have a collaborative research program with Williams, but I certainly was not going to have a critical attitude toward him because I owed to him my presence here, and it's a debt that that's a very lasting one. Now, I don't know what you want
Maybe we might just say a little bit more about Williams and then drop the subject. There was something about his space, the amount of space he had, and apparently he was getting grants from, what was it, Rockefeller or?
Well.
Or from wherever Weaver was associated.
The ultracentrifuge was established here by the Rockefeller Foundation.
Uh-huh.
And it was apparently the first large grant the university had received from such a source, and there was even some doubt as to whether the university would accept
it.
This, of course, is long before I came here. In the end, a special building was built for the ultracentrifuge behind the old chemistry building, so that if it ever blew up, it wouldn't endanger the main building, but I don't really know anything about what was going on in those days.
And Williams was the only one essentially who dealt with it.
Oh, yes.
And did he, you feel that he adequately exploited its uses?
Oh, yes, I think so.
But at some point, another method was devised, or another piece of equipment which put it out of
use.
Yes,
the Spinco ultracentrifuge was eventually developed, which had a completely different principle, and was a simpler piece of equipment, and one that was manufactured commercially. It eventually made the original Svedberg ultracentrifuge obsolete.
Yes.
But
is this in the late 40s or the 50s?
I would say it was around 1950, probably, that it first became available. It's been improved quite a lot since.
And Jack Williams didn't adequately take to it, didn't exploit it enough. Somebody said that. I've forgotten who it was.
Well, I don't know. I don't think That's.
I mean, they said it gently. Yes. Just felt that.
Well, Williams kept on using the old machine, mm-hmm. and I think Williams felt for a while that the old machine gave better results than the new one.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably did, mm-hmm. for a while, until the new one had gone through a number of improvements.
Yeah. Well, so how important was he? Was he a brilliant researcher, Jack Williams?
Well, do I really have to evaluate that?
You'd be in a position to, yeah. I should think.
I wouldn't say that he was really an extremely important leader.
Mm.
He did many good things, and he brought many good students to Wisconsin. I would say his name is not going to appear in the textbooks for decades,
yeah.
to come.
So he apparently was a problem for the department, and perhaps legitimately so. That he said something about when you moved to the new building, there wasn't going to be space for him. And he felt very bitter about that.
I'm sorry to hear it. I guess I wasn't.
Well, you'll hear
really
it when you listen to his interview.
And of course.
I think in the end he got some, but.
Yes, I was chairman at the time, and I don't recall. Conflicts of this sort. It's true that he probably had somewhat less space here than he did.
I thought it had to do with Daniels.
Oh. Well, let's see. Yeah, of course that's true, because I became chairman in 67, and we moved into this building in 62.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't
have
had anything to do with,
yeah.
the assignment of Williams' space.
Mm-hmm.
He was bitter about Daniels in many respects.
And legitimately so?
I think in some respects, yes. For example, he told me once that after his retirement party, which happened when I was out of the country, many of Jack's former students were here, and Daniels said to him afterwards, well, I guess it's true you never did anything by yourself. It was only your students who did your work, or something like that. I can't imagine Daniels making such a terrible remark, but that's what Williams told me. And I know Daniels told me on another occasion when Williams was in the chairman's office, and Williams had been complaining about a number of things, and Daniels said, "Don't you like anybody?" And Williams fainted, and Daniels was horribly worried that he'd had a heart attack or something.
Hmm.
I don't know whether these things really ought to go into the record.
Actually, Williams spoke about fainting once at the university club,
oh.
all that during the war, from
yes.
overwork,
yes.
I guess. But Well, maybe just you could say something about Farrington Daniels, because there have been rather, perhaps not even conflicting reports about him. Oh, thank you.
I don't have any general comments to make about him, I guess.
Was he a good chairman?
I think he was a pretty good chairman. He was somewhat more autocratic than his successors had been. Matthews, of course, was rather autocratic too. The department in later years has been divided into divisions of organic chemistry, physical chemistry, and so forth, and these divisions have developed a good deal of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
But in Daniel's time, he ran the department in a rather centralized way. During his tenure, I was chairman of the Division of Physical Chemistry, but I don't think I did very much in that office.
Yes. If I had asked the question, what kind of a chairman was Daniels, what would you have said? Just that he was autocratic? Did he build up the department the way you felt it should be built up?
Well, there were some good appointments and some that turned out not so well. He raised money for the beginning of the new building, for the first segment of the building we now occupy. I would say he was a good chairman, but not a brilliant chairman. I'm afraid I don't have much comment about
all
that.
All right. Is there anything else you'd want to say about the department as a department, as the collegiality of it, and the kind of stimulation you got? Or maybe that belongs in when you're talking about your research. But
well, I could make a few comments. Matthews had department meetings at lunch twice a month, whether there was any business to transact or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an extremely good procedure, and it was followed by Daniels and also by me. But after my term as chairman was over, this was gradually discontinued, and I have felt that the department has become increasingly fragmented, not perhaps with respect to any dissension, but people have just been ignoring each other. In Matthew's time, and I'm sure this was a carryover from earlier years, the organic chemists were a separate group whose goals seemed often to be different from those of the rest of the department.
How do you mean?
Well, they were concerned about their own interests and were more aggressive in promoting their own interests above those of others in the department than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this is not uncommon in chemistry departments all over the country.
Do you mean the organic chemists do that, or one group?
It's the organic chemists who do it, yes.
Do they feel that chemistry really belongs to them?
I suppose so, because their chemistry is true chemistry, meaning it involves chemical reactions and transformations of one compound to another. Although in more recent years, the inorganic chemists have been increasingly doing work of this sort, synthesizing new compounds, synthetic chemistry, rather than physical chemistry, which is concerned with the interrelations of physical and chemical properties and relations to molecular structure. I was very much impressed, speaking of the department in general, by the quality of the supporting services here. The fact that I could have anything I wanted to made in the machine shop without paying for it out of my research grants was an enormous advantage in getting started with my my research. One of our most important pieces of equipment was too big to be made in the chemistry shops and was made in the general university shops. An enormous project. This was the Fitzgerald apparatus, which I may refer to later on. And I never knew how much it cost, but but it must have cost the department quite a lot. And the department also has had excellent glassblowing shops, which these are very important in for the organic chemists, especially. And then in later years, as scientific technology developed, all kinds of very elaborate instruments had been bought by the department and have been used free of charge by all members of the department. In some chemistry departments, individual professors have to pay for that sort of thing out of their own research grants.
I see. Huh.
I've also been extremely happy in the university with relations with the graduate school and the College of Letters and Science, in that in dealing with outside funding, it was never necessary to go through departmental channels. The chairman would usually sign some form just automatically, but we as individual professors have always dealt directly with the graduate school or with the College of Letters and Science. I don't know whether you ever interviewed Robert Doremus.
I did, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Talked some about this.
I enjoyed
this.
Very much working with him. And I've had research support from practically every government agency over the years. And it's been very easy with help from the administration and the paperwork and red tape, much more cooperative than I gather is the case at some universities. Not all my colleagues, I think, shared my enthusiasm. I don't know what troubles they had, but do you want to turn it off? Unless you have some questions now.
You turn to your research now.
I've mentioned that I was very eager to explore the subject of viscoelasticity in polymers, And we tried to develop various kinds of apparatus for making viscoelastic measurements, especially in oscillating deformations. A very important breakthrough was made possible by my graduate student, Edwin Fitzgerald, who had had a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Wisconsin, had spent some time during the war doing electrical measurements at the B.F. Goodrich Company, and returned here enrolling for graduate work in physics. He wanted to work on polymers. There was no one in physics interested in polymers, so an arrangement was made that he could do his research with me, although it would be judged by the physics department. He designed and had constructed a marvelous instrument which enabled measurements of viscoelastic properties over wide ranges of frequency of oscillating deformations and temperature, and also of the mechanical properties of the polymeric material being investigated, which could vary all the way from very soft gel-like material to a very hard solid. And this instrument, which he eventually patented, we used for several decades. We could never have made the progress we did without the data obtained from this instrument. I estimated at one point that we made 50,000 measurements of viscoelastic properties, and on many many different polymers and polymer solutions. I remarked that it was patented. A few of these instruments were constructed and sold to other laboratories, but very few. Fitzgerald later went to Penn State in the mechanics physics department, I guess, and then to Johns Hopkins in the Department of Mechanics. We collected enormous amounts of data which could never have been correlated and reduced to simple generalizations without application of what I called reduced variables, and some other people called time temperature superposition or frequency temperature superposition, which I can't go into the technical aspects of, but it was a principle of equivalence of changing temperature and changing time or frequency. This principle had been in the literature in various places and had been especially exploited by Arthur Tobolsky, whose name I had mentioned in a different kind of experiment. I formulated it perhaps a little more precisely than had been done before, and by means of this principle, we could take hundreds of measurements and combine them together to produce two basic functions, one a function of temperature and the other a function of frequency. And we collected a lot of such data and began analyzing these two basic functions. The temperature function was somewhat similar for different polymers, and we were looking for some way of of describing how different polymers differed with respect to the temperature function that I won't stop to explain exactly what this function was. My graduate student Malcolm Williams, who had received his PhD and was staying on for a few months as a research associate, discovered a way of plotting up data on different polymers so that they all fell on the same function. This was a very important breakthrough, and I said that he should publish this under his own name as a communication to the editor, which he did in the Journal of the American Chemical Society. But then I sat down and found an equation which would describe this general curve. To start with, it was just a curve on a piece of graph paper. And then found that I could make a theory to describe this equation on the basis of the role of something called free volume and its relation to the rates of molecular motions in the polymer. And this we put together with the help of another graduate student who had just received his PhD, Robert Landel. This produced the so-called WLF equation, the Williams-Landel-Ferry equation, which has been very widely used ever since. And this is probably the most important thing we ever did here.
I see. So this would be a sequence of events to explore, beginning with the how the machine was developed.
Well, first you have thousands of data.
First you have to invent the machine.
That's right. Yes.
And I would be interested as to, had he thought of that when he came here?
No. He'd only been doing electrical measurements, but there's a certain parallelism between the electrical measurements with oscillating voltage and the mechanical measurements with oscillating force. Some of these parallel concepts are mentioned in one of the papers I gave you. Fitzgerald had remarkable insight in how to design this machine. He did it here. Yes. As part of it was his PhD work.
I see. Did you propose it to him, or how did the idea come up?
We'd already developed a crude forerunner of this machine. Who I mentioned had been a major in the Army, this is Robert Marvin, constructed what we called a twin transducer, which would make measurements of this sort, but of a far more restricted type. Fitzgerald saw that this instrument could be enormously improved.
Mm-hmm. And what is your role in here? Two pieces of equipment that are developed. What is your role in that?
Well,
or the professor's role.
I propose the concepts,
and you know that there must be some way
and the general idea that you could put together some magnets and coils and springs and things and make a machine that would make the measurements that we want. But the details of exactly how you would construct this device were always performed by the students involved. For example, the Fitzgerald apparatus had many remarkable features. One was that it contained a huge magnet, but the entire instrument had to be assembled before the magnet was magnetized. Otherwise, it would be impossible to put it together because of the magnetic forces. Mm. So the whole thing was assembled, and then we took it down to a place in Indiana where it could be put in an enormous magnetic field and have the magnet magnetized.
Do you remember how you went about? I mean, did you go in every day and see what he was doing, and how did you?
No, quite a lot of it. He drew dozens of very detailed mechanical drawings showing dimensions and angles and type of material, and I didn't have much to do with those details.
Yeah.
Another feature, which we joked about, was that he had to have a coil wound, a coil with many, many turns of fine electrical wire on the inside of a cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
He also had coils on the outside of a cylinder. But how were you going to make a coil on the inside of a cylinder? What he did, I think I may have had some role in suggesting this. I'm not sure. He made a coil on glucose glass, which is a piece of candy, just the right dimensions. And then he cemented this on the inside of his metal cylinder.
Yeah, and then melted the candy.
The candy with water.
Was this something new? Had anybody ever done this before?
Not that I know of. Well, that's just an example of his ingenuity.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and how long a period of time did it take to develop this machine?
It took several years. He, I think he got his degree in 51. He started work in 46. Well, maybe hardly until 47.
Mm.
And I think it was operated by 1950, probably. We had to make a major change in the design at one point because, are you coming to the end?
Yes.
Because the part of the design involved clamping a part of the apparatus strongly so that it wouldn't move under magnetic force. It turned out that we simply couldn't clamp it hard enough. There was no such thing as absolute clamping, and we had to change the design so that instead of clamping against a fixed object,